Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Attorney Shana Katadal with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who assesses the Bush administration's legal defense of their warrantless domestic surveillance program. Lori Wallach of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who discusses strategy options for opponents of trade agreements reached at the December World Trade Organization Summit meeting in Hong Kong. And Dr. Ed Lyman, senior staff scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists, who explains why he's worried about nuclear proliferation if the Bush administration resumes plutonium reprocessing. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In his State of the Union speech, President George Bush made the obvious point that America is addicted to oil. The nation's dependence on natural gas comes a close second. According to The Nation magazine, natural gas heats 45% of American homes, powers 31% of U.S. industry and agriculture, and supplies 14% of the energy used to produce electricity. Currently, America relies on North American natural gas reserves to meet these energy needs. In the near future, the U.S. is expected to join Europe in depending on the top five natural gas suppliers: Russia, Iran, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. The U.S. currently has only 3% of the world's proven natural gas reserves. Russia, with 27% of all proven global natural gas fields, has flexed its energy muscle. It provoked a New Year's confrontation to force Ukraine to pay the market price for natural gas. While Iran is under threat of sanctions over its nuclear enrichment program, the Islamic nation has made deals with energy-hungry countries as diverse as France, Norway, Italy, Japan, and India. Because of diminishing supplies of petroleum and the low-emission advantages of natural gas, the global challenge ahead will be to encourage cooperation over competition to satisfy the world's increasing energy appetite. With the swearing-in of Samuel Alito to the U.S. Supreme Court, the anti-abortion movement is looking for a new battleground. Several groups, including the 300,000-member American Life League, are calling for a full-scale assault on birth control. They object to most forms of birth control, including the morning-after pill. As American Life League founder Judy Brown told the Progressive magazine, pro-lifers must see the connection between contraception and abortion. In early 2005, 30 anti-abortion activists met in Chicago to discuss crafting a position opposing birth control. Joe Scheidler, head of the militant Pro-Life Action League, who in the 1980s led protests outside of women's health clinics, organized the gathering. A follow-up meeting is scheduled for this spring, which hopes to broaden opposition among social conservatives to what is dubbed the contraceptive mentality. Already, right-wingers have attempted to undermine the credibility of condom use by insisting they promote promiscuity. Health experts say condoms are vital in encouraging safe sex practices and protection against the spread of HIV/AIDS. Yet the Food and Drug Administration, under pressure from conservatives, has proposed putting a warning label on condoms. Despite the flurry of activity, major anti-abortion groups, Concerned Women of America, the Christian Coalition, and Focus on the Family have no official position on birth control. President Bush also remains silent on the issue. In the midst of the U.S. nuclear confrontation with Iran, the Bush administration briefly joined forces with the Islamic State to block the application of two gay rights organizations seeking non-governmental organization status at the United Nations. The U.S. rejected the application of the International Gay and Lesbian Rights Commission, but in 2002, the Bush administration endorsed its application for observer status to the UN Economic and Social Council. In late January, however, the Council rejected the application on a 10-5 vote as the U.S. sided with Asian, Middle Eastern, and African nations. The application for a Danish gay rights NGO was also rejected. In response to the American Anti-Gay Alliance with Tehran, Human Rights Watch sent a letter of protest signed by 40 groups, including Amnesty International and the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Scott Long of Human Rights Watch stated, "It is astonishing that the Bush administration would align itself with Sudan, China, Iran, and Zimbabwe in a coalition of the homophobic." In its latest Human Rights Annual Report, the U.S. State Department criticized Iran's use of the death penalty to punish male homosexual activity. Iran's crackdown on gays sparked outrage in Europe when two teenage boys were hanged in July 2005 for engaging in homosexual acts. According to the news magazine In These Times, the teenagers were known in the local gay underground, and rape charges against them were fabricated. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
In a hearing conducted by the Senate Judiciary Committee on February 6th, Bush administration Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez defended the legality of the president's authorization of the National Security Agency's warrantless domestic surveillance program. The program, which the White House says is intended to prevent future terrorist attacks, has monitored international electronic communications involving individuals living in the U.S. since shortly after September 11, 2001. Gonzalez repeated the justifications offered by the president for bypassing existing laws restricting government surveillance. The attorney general said the administration viewed the post-9/11 congressional authorization to use force in Afghanistan as providing the legal basis to bypass the 1978 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that requires the executive branch to obtain court orders for all domestic wiretaps from a special FISA court. Other arguments made by Gonzalez for the program's legality included surveillance conducted by previous presidents before the FISA Act was signed into law. Democrats and some key Republicans on the committee were vocally skeptical of the White House rationale. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Shana Katadal, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, which, along with the ACLU, have filed lawsuits against President Bush and other top officials challenging the legality of the NSA spy program. Katadal explains why he believes that the Bush administration has broken the law and what's at stake for the U.S. Constitution and the nation's system of checks and balances.
It's a blatantly illegal program. Congress has made all electronic surveillance outside of the Wiretap Act and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act a felony. Usually when you start a lawsuit, you have a great deal of uncertainty about the law, but you're pretty sure you know what the facts are. And here it's quite the opposite. We have absolute certainty that the law is on our side, and nothing, that was said by the Attorney General or by the President in a State of the Union address really changes that. But the big mystery here is really not whether this program was legal, because it's clearly not legal, but rather why they did it and who they were eavesdropping on. Were our clients targets? Who precisely were the targets of this program?
Well, who are your clients, and what's your guess as to the motivation?
Sure. Well, our clients are, a number of, non-citizens, most of them now located overseas, who, have challenged the government's detention and interrogation practices in the war on terror. So, for instance, we represent the Guantanamo detainees. We represent the vast class of immigration detainees swept up right after 9/11 and abused while in detention and then deported, months after they had deportation orders while waiting in U.S. prisons for the FBI to sort of clear them of terrorism charges. So those individuals are all overseas. And then we represent a man named Maher Arar, a Canadian citizen who was stopped while changing planes at JFK and sent not to his home country of Canada, but to Syria for months of torture. So all those individuals are located overseas, and we need to communicate with them regularly and with witnesses in their cases located overseas and with other human rights lawyers located overseas in the course of, fighting their litigation, their cases against the government. And it's those communications, that we think sort of fit, very closely the sort of profile that the government has given of what they're trying to surveil here. They've said that this program is really targeted against people with some affiliation, no matter how, sort of attenuated or unsubstantiated by any evidence, some affiliation with terrorism. And the government has asserted, again, without any evidence in detaining all these clients originally, that they were somehow affiliated with terrorism, even though they've never been able to back it up with a shred of evidence. And so we think that, given the fact that we litigate these cases, our communications with our clients, with these clients overseas, are precisely the type of communications that the government is probably eavesdropping upon. So that's one reason we brought this case. But then beyond that, the fact that these are the kind of cases that we bring, that we typically sue the government on behalf of non-citizens, often located overseas, the existence of this program makes it very difficult for us to function as lawyers, given that these are the type of cases that we usually bring.
In U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez's testimony, he primarily defended the administration's behavior by saying several things, among them the FISA courts were too slow, that the Afghan war authorization granted by Congress included the authority to have this warrantless surveillance, and that leaders of Congress knew about the surveillance but didn't complain.
I mean, the first one, the one that's been heard the most often, has been this notion that the FISA court is just too slow. And that's an absolutely absurd argument. FISA allows the government to put wiretaps in place first and then go to the court for retroactive approval up to 3 days later. So the government has 72 hours to go to the court in these emergency situations and get a warrant. It's pretty minimal what the Attorney General has to do, at the outset, really. They've just got to inform the FISA court, they're putting a wiretap into place. The Attorney General said today, look, a problem is that if we didn't have enough information to justify it once the 72 hours rolls around and we go to the court and the court rejects our application, then we're supposed to inform the target of the investigation that they were listened in on illegally. But again, that's kind of a strange worry given how few requests for wiretap orders the court actually turns down. Then the other argument is that somehow this authorization to use force in Afghanistan implicitly gave the president the power to carry out all this wiretapping on calls that enter the United States. It's very disingenuous. First of all, Congress made minor adjustments to the wiretapping statutes in December 2001 at the request of the Justice Department, and that was just a few weeks after passing the authorization to use force. So Congress wouldn't have needed to do that sort of thing if it intended to authorize just wholesale surveillance with the AUMF. And then beyond that, in his December 19th press briefing, the first time the administration had really spoken in detail to this program, the Attorney General said that the administration had thought about asking Congress for approval of changes to the FISA statute that would make this NSA program legal. But they didn't ask then for permission because they thought Congress was not going to grant it. They thought Congress would reject them. And so it's kind of disingenuous for the administration to say on the one hand that Congress implicitly approved of this sort of wholesale wiretapping program back when they authorized the government to invade Afghanistan, while also saying that they thought Congress would not have approved of it explicitly.
Well, just a final quick question here. Beyond the realm of the law and what's happening in the Senate or Congress or even the courts, what do you feel the role of the public here is when our government institutions fail to work, fail to hold those in power accountable?
Most individual Congress people don't feel like they have an incentive to stand in the way of the executive on national security issues, and I think the public needs to make it clear to their elected officials in Congress that this is an important issue for them. And every time you call your congressperson to complain about something like this, they assume that there are 100 other people out there who felt the same way who didn't pick up the phone. So you've got leverage on your side if you want to send a letter to your congressperson or call them up. But I think it's important that individual members of Congress realize that this is an important issue for the American public.
That was Shaina Katadal, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Contact the center by calling area code 212-614-6464 or visit the group's website at www.ccr-ny.org. International opponents of neoliberal economic and free trade policies promoted by Washington are now assessing the fallout from agreements reached at the World Trade Organization Ministerial Summit held in Hong Kong in December. Twice before, WTO summits had collapsed in Seattle and Cancun due to disagreements between developing and industrial nations over agricultural subsidies. But in Hong Kong, marked by militant protests by farmers from around the world, a last-minute accord was reached when the U.S. and European Union agreed to cut export subsidies to their farmers by 2013. Many observers believe that India and Brazil became key players in facilitating the Hong Kong agreement when they abandoned their former role as leaders of poor nations that had opposed policies primarily benefiting Western corporate interests in past WTO negotiations. During the 6th World Social Forum held in Caracas, Venezuela in late January, there was much discussion and debate about how progressive activists, poor farmers, and governments opposed to trade liberalization should proceed to effectively resist implementation of the WTO Hong Kong agreement that will next move to Geneva for further negotiations. Lori Wallach, director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, spoke optimistically of the fight ahead when she participated in a panel discussion at the World Social Forum in Caracas on January 28th.
To reiterate, as a progressive person coming from the U.S., how incredibly inspiring it is to be here in Venezuela, but to also be in South America in proximity to the elections of Evo Morales, to Tavares in Uruguay, to Kirchner in Argentina, to Lula and the project there. And it's inspiring, and I thank all of our brothers and sisters from South America for not just the inspiration, but the lessons. Because in the U.S. is a very gruesome time now, and I will only share that we are fighting, but it is the inspiration of what has been accomplished here, I have to say, that will energize me for many months going back. So thank you very much. I'm going to focus on some of the opportunities for our work together to derail the WTO. The WTO has 900 pages of non-trade rules, one size fits all. We have to think about it really as a very quiet, slow-motion coup d'etat against democratic governance, because it's a global governance system that has strong enforcement. And its rules tell us what our governments can do, who can own and operate services inside our countries. Can they be public? Must they be private? How we spend our own tax dollars for the procurement of our government's goods and services? Who elected these guys? What are even the domestic food systems we can have to make sure people are not going hungry? The rules about how we can use our own land. If your country does not follow these rules, your country is dragged into a tribunal that meets in secret in Geneva, Switzerland, and this tribunal is empowered to rule. It does not matter if the decision is democratic. It's been okay in your courts. If the WTO tribunal says this is not allowed, your law has to go, or you face perpetual trade sanctions. This is like having a gun at the head of democracy if you step out of these WTO rules. So this is now where we are. This is the system. And so the fact that this document, this agenda, was able to get out of Hong Kong alive is a very serious problem. We need to be very clear on the goal. The goal is to derail. This is not an agenda that with a little change can be fixed. And we have to replace the existing WTO. So right now, what we've got is we need to stop the metastases of a cancer. It's going to kill us totally, immediately, if we don't stop the spread. There are many alternatives. We're not against trade, any of us, but we need to get rid of this expansion, get rid of the old system, and replace it. There is enormous power against us. There are corporations who are seeking the agenda of Hong Kong, who are pushing every day. They're in our capitals. It doesn't matter if they're based in Japan or U.S. or Europe or Brazil or wherever. They're in all of our countries. And they're in the WTO headquarters. The goal is by the end of December to have a finished agreement. Now, that short deadline is also good news for us, because they have to come up with agreement on about 500 different things. They were in such desperation not to let the whole thing implode that they made this deal, but they had to paper over a lot of really big things that they couldn't agree on. In the end, what we're up against is our governments making decisions. Who can hold a government accountable? The people who can vote them out, or in the case of Ecuador and Bolivia, chase them out. So, coordinating internationally our national campaigns, we can identify a short list of Achilles' heels. They need to fix 300 disagreements. We need just to find 3 to 7 Achilles' heels and then figure out how we all kick in the same place internationally. And that will be the way we derail this agreement. So we're all in this car, and there's a lot of pressure to put us on a road, and we already know it's going towards a cliff, and they want to speed it up with this Hong Kong ministerio. Ladies and gentlemen, compañeras and compañeros, we are the emergency brake. We've got 3 months to pull it, and let's start working. Thank you very much.
That was Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, participating in a panel discussion held at the World Social Forum in Caracas, Venezuela on January 28th. Contact Trade Watch by calling area code 202-546-4996 or visit their website at www.citizen.org/trade. Her talk was recorded by Between the Lines' Scott Harris. In President Bush's State of the Union speech on January 31st, in which he declared that the U.S. is addicted to oil, he promoted another form of energy in these four words: clean, safe nuclear power. But opponents of nuclear power with serious concerns about the technology's toxic waste and high costs say two words unmentioned in the speech are important to factor into the equation of whether nuclear power is going to get a second lease on life in the U.S. Those two words are plutonium reprocessing. Last year, the federal budget included $50 million to come up with a plan for integrated spent fuel recycling facilities, in other words, plutonium reprocessing. It's been promoted both as a means of creating more nuclear fuel and as a way of dealing with nuclear waste. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Dr. Ed Lyman, senior staff scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists. He explains how the process works, why it was halted once before in the U.S., and why he's concerned about nuclear proliferation if plutonium reprocessing goes forward.
The fact that the president didn't mention reprocessing in his speech was anticipated and not unexpected. But that doesn't mean that it's not going to be taking place under the radar screen. In fact, I believe that the president's advisors made a calculation that this was a program that was best if it didn't attract public attention, because so many aspects of it don't make sense or would be controversial.
So how exactly does plutonium reprocessing work?
The purpose would be to take commercial spent nuclear fuel from nuclear power plants to reprocess it, which is perform a complicated series of chemical operations on that spent fuel to separate the plutonium it contains from other constituents and possibly to turn that plutonium into some type of reactor fuel that could, in principle, be used again. It's anticipated that any such facility would cost anywhere from $10 to $30 billion.
What would be the rationale for any government to do this?
At the dawn of the nuclear power era, it was anticipated that this would be the way to deal with spent fuel from nuclear power plants. In fact, there were plans to go in that direction in the 60s and the 1970s. But the major concern associated with reprocessing spent fuel as opposed to directly disposing of it in a repository like the Yucca Mountain repository that people may be familiar with is that the process extracts materials which could be used in a nuclear weapon. And the Ford and Carter administrations, when they became aware of exactly how much plutonium would end up circulating in the commercial nuclear industry if these plans were actually realized, understood that the proliferation dangers associated with this technology were simply too great to be controlled, and that instead of reprocessing spent fuel and separating the plutonium from other radioactive constituents, plutonium should be kept with those radioactive constituents and spent fuel should simply be put underground. And that has been the essentially the policy of the United States domestic program for several decades. the danger now is that if the Bush administration reverses that policy, not only will it expose hundreds of tons of plutonium in the spent fuel that's now been generated to potentially being diverted or stolen by terrorist groups for a nuclear weapon, but it also send exactly the wrong signal internationally at a time when the non-proliferation regime is threatening to really collapse, and a time when more controls are needed over nuclear materials, not fewer controls.
You've highlighted a very serious concern regarding nuclear terrorism. Can you also talk about the issue of environmental contamination from the intended operation of this process? I understand that a facility that operated in the U.S. several years in the late 60s, I think it was closed down because of high levels of radioactive pollution.
Reprocessing technology itself is also, from a waste management and environmental perspective, the wrong thing to do with nuclear waste, because it takes an object, you know, a spent fuel assembly, which is, although, you know, contains a soup of radioactive elements in it, they are fairly well contained as long as the fuel is undamaged. Reprocessing would expose the contents of spent fuel to the potential for environmental releases by the nature of the process, which is to take the spent fuel, chop it up, release gases that are inside it, dissolve it in acid, and then subject it to complicated chemical operations, which generate lots of radioactive waste and involve corrosive and potentially explosive materials. And there have been some spectacular accidents involving reprocessing waste products in Soviet Union 1957, and we've even had a few incidents in this country. There was one failed attempt at commercial reprocessing in the 1960s at a plant in New York called West Valley. The plant operated only for a few years, had a very troubled operating record, ended up closing and leaving a legacy of radioactive waste, which New York State is still dealing with.
That was Dr. Ed Lyman of the Union of Concerned Scientists. Contact the group by calling area code 202-233-6133 or visit their website at www.ucsusa.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Banzari.